none of this would be happening if there wasn't already a huge demand for these products. So how can we try and stop that? Well, with us to speculate is Sabri Zain. He's the Director of Policy at the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Organisation called TRAFFIC. So why does this demand exist, Sabri, in the first place?
Demand for ivory and rhino horn and other products, I mean, they've existed for years for a variety of uses, whether it's traditional use or ornamental. The challenge now, I think, is far more complex issue right now. Markets are changing. A lot of these countries now have been booming economies. With rhino horn, for example, it's not just traditional medicine now. It's also used as hangover cure, or it's used for corporate gifting. So there are a lot of psychological reasons behind the demand. And you know, our approach to reducing this demand has to be a lot more sophisticated.
What do you do to try and change the behaviour of the men, women and children on the street?
This goes beyond awareness raising through posters and TV spots because, as I said before, you're looking not just at traditional usage, you're looking at people's lifestyles, people's attitudes and motivations. So to address that problem, we really need to understand the consumer down to, you know, the psychological traits such as what are the motivations, beliefs, attitudes of this consumer towards this product, and what can we do to change that behaviour. The person may be buying an ivory tusk as a corporate gift. So we've been working with Chinese auction houses, for example, who are offering animal-themed figures in amber, in jade, which will make a splendid corporate gift. So you don't need to kill an elephant to get what the status that you seek.
All right, so once you understand why those products are being used, it becomes much easier to then try and change behaviour. And where does this message need to come from?
We've done a lot of studies which shows that the last person this message should come from is a conservation NGO such as mine, because a lot of these consumers will say, oh, you're a conservation NGO. Of course you'll say that. I'm not going to believe you. So we really have to make sure that we get the right messengers. Celebrities work with a wide audience, but what we've found is that, for example, a lot of the corporate gifting, a lot of the career advancement motivations of these people, we need to use business leaders who these people look on as models, saying, nope, this kind of behaviour is not acceptable. And they will model themselves to that.
What's the level of commitment at the top level, government level, to actually do this kind of thing? Are countries motivated to help in this mission, or actually don't they care?
I think people now recognise that, you know, if you don't address the demand that is driving this trade, wildlife traders will find whatever way they can to circumvent the law. And I think there's a growing recognition of that. The UN General Assembly resolution on wildlife trafficking that was adopted in 2015 highlighted demand reduction as an important issue. And CITES had its first ever resolution on demand reduction as well. There's a major conference being held in London in October this year. Heads of state are going to be there. This high-level commitment is very important to making sure that action on the ground happens.
Do these organisations actually have teeth? Can they do something?
CITES certainly has teeth. Not only is it a legally binding treaty, but countries that do not comply with CITES provisions face trade sanctions in CITES-listed species. So, for example, last year, Thailand was under threat of a CITES sanction if they did not address their illegal ivory problems. And a CITES trade sanction for Thailand would result in billions in losses, for example, their orchid trade. So, you know, CITES does have teeth, but I think CITES also can provide the support, the expertise, the knowledge to help these countries address these problems.
And has all this been successful? Are you seeing things, the direction of travel, if you like, being in the right direction?
One of the most significant conservation successes of the last year was China imposing a ban on its commercial ivory trade. That is going to have a huge impact. If 3 years ago you told me that, you know, China was going to ban its ivory trade, I would have said, oh, whatever you're smoking, I want some. So, you know, that's not the end of the story. It's going to have a huge impact, but it can also move the market elsewhere. So countries really need to follow suit so as not to undermine the successes that we found in China.
And just bringing you back in, Sam Wasser, you've been listening to that. Does this give you cause to be enthused that you think things are going in the right direction?
I think we're still in a pretty scary place myself. I think that a lot of countries are not doing all that they can in the situation. I think that sometimes things are not what they seem. And I'll just give you an example with China. So it's wonderful that China has closed down their markets. But when you look at all of the ivory that is being seized each year, in my opinion, there's far more than what's ending up in markets. And what I think is actually happening is some very wealthy people are buying these large whole tusks, and they're actually stockpiling those and waiting for conditions to open up again, perhaps if elephants go extinct, and then they will make a fortune. So when that kind of thing happens, all of these fixes are complicated, and that's not to say that we don't need everything. We clearly need demand reduction. Demand reduction is the way that we keep those individuals that are stockpiling from being able to profit from it. But until that happens, it's very, very complicated.
Going forward, I mean, there's this conference coming up. What change would you like to see implemented?
Again, I'm a big proponent of demand reduction. The one problem I have with it is I think it's too slow. Because we are killing so many elephants. If we're killing 40,000 a year and there's 400,000 left, we have an urgency. And when we take a large seizure and we genotype it and get this information from it, it's so valuable what it tells us about how this trade is operating, who's connected. And one of the biggest problems is that we get these seizures very late. We get them 1, sometimes 2 years late. And what we need to do is we need to make these countries understand how important to give us access to that information as quickly as we can so it has the maximal law enforcement action tied to it.
Sabri, would you agree? What would you like to see in October?
Absolutely agree with everything that Sam said. We've seen incremental progress, incremental change, but we really haven't seen this push towards the systemic problems that are causing illegal wildlife trade. Corruption, poverty, ensuring that there's a strong local community engagement and buy-in into anti-poaching activities. I think what the conference would benefit greatly from looking at those broader themes, looking at not just seizing ivory, but looking at financial crime, following the money to where the kingpins are. There's still not enough of that being done. And engaging the private sector, the transport companies, e-commerce companies, and especially online technology companies, because as these physical markets are being shut down around the world, that's where all the wildlife traders are going to. They're going online, they're going to social media, and I'm not sure we're ready to tackle that, and we really have to be prepared.
Thank you, Sabri. So it is a really complicated problem we're dealing with here. And like Sam said, we're running out of time, but it's really excellent to hear about these success stories. So hopefully there'll be a lot more to come. Thank you, everyone who was on the programme. That's Sabri Zain, Grant Miller, Sam Wasser, Andrew Sakala, and Paul Dion Ellis.